Tonight's class has been sponsored by Mayan Yisrael. And this is in the honor of the speedy recovery and the complete refuah shlema of Shlomo Matisyahu ben Kela. Let him have an absolute recovery. Let him be healthier than before. The CD this week has been sponsored by Mr. Arthur Diller. And this is in honor of his grandmother, whose yahrzeit is going to be on Friday on Yud Av, day after Tisha B'Av. And the name is Gittel Bas Michoel. May her neshama have a tremendous aliyah and send a lot of blessings down this way to his family and to everyone else. This week, or tonight, we're standing a night before Tisha B'Av. May Hashem help that tomorrow night, we're going to celebrate Tisha B'Av in a completely different way than we've always had, with explosive joy and extensive feasting and singing and dancing. And definitely there won't be any Jew who will be upset and mind and have complaints of why we're not doing the traditional Tisha B'Av. We're all ready for a new kind of Tisha B'Av, and we deserve it. The Jewish people deserve a happy Tisha B'Av. So may Hashem help that this should be the great and happy Tisha B'Av. No matter what, whether we are relating to the past Tisha B'Avs of sadness and mourning, or the future Tisha B'Avs of joy and happiness, Tisha B'Av is about the Beis HaMikdash. It's about the Holy Temple. The past two temples that we're mourning for, or the third Beis HaMikdash that we're longing for, it's still the Beis HaMikdash. We need to know what is the significance of the Beis HaMikdash in our lives. What does the Beis HaMikdash mean to me and to you? To all of us. We all know that we have three Beis HaMikdashes. Two in the past, one in the future. So what is the meaning not only of the Beis HaMikdash, but of the three Batei Mikdash in our own lives? The Shabbos, the parsha of the week, is Parshas Ve'eschanan. But the dominating factor of the Shabbos, as mentioned last week, is the Haftorah, not the parsha, but the Haftorah is stronger the Shabbos. The common name for the Shabbos is not Shabbos Veschanon, but it is Shabbos Nachamu. Shabbos Nachamu, due to the opening words of the Haftorah of the great comfort, where God comforts the Jewish people. Nachamu, Nachamu Ami. Be comforted, my people. Why the double comfort? Nachamu, Nachamu. So the Medrash, Yalkut Shemoyni, on Yeshaya, in this pasuk of Nachamu Nachamu Ami, says, the Jewish people are weeping, Bachoi Sifke Balayla. She cries and she weeps at night. A double weeping. Because we have suffered a double blow. And the loss of the first Beis HaMikdash, and the loss of the second Beis HaMikdash. So Hashem comes to comfort us two times. Nachamu al bayis rishon. Be comforted for the first Beis HaMikdash. Nachamu al bayis sheni. Be comforted for the second Beis Hamikdash. That's the significance of the two comforts. However, when we think about the way God comforts us, how different that is from the way of human comforting. When a human being goes to comfort someone due to our limitations, we can't restore that which the person lost. The person lost a loved one. We're not capable of resurrection, of Tchias HaMesim. We can't bring them back their loss. At best, we can ease the pain. We can hold their hand, show them we're with them in their darkest moment. We can give them a shoulder to cry on and alleviate some of the intensity of the pain. Hashem, however, His nechama, His comforting is very different. When He comforts us, the comforting is the replacing of that which we've lost. The restoration of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Holy Temple. Just like when Hashem comforted us when we lost the first Beis HaMikdash, the nechama, the nachamu that Hashem gave us was that He built us a second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash comforted because we had now what we lost. But it was an incomplete comfort. Because as the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Yuma, that the second Beis HaMikdash didn't fully replace the first Beis HaMikdash. There were certain elements of the divine presence that was revealed in the first Beis HaMikdash that wasn't there in the second Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara bases it on a pasuk where it says, Alu ahar v'aveisem eitz. Go up onto the mountain, bring a wood, ubnu abayis, and build the home, build the Beis HaMikdash. Ve'ertzeba, and I will desire it. Ve'ikavdabai, and I will become glorified in it. Through the Beis HaMikdash, I will be glorified. The word ve'ikavda is missing, is lacking a hey. It says ve'ikaved. It's read v'kaved. I'm sorry. It's written v'kaved. It's read the way we read the word. The traditional reading is v'kavda with a hey, but it's missing the letter hey, and that is indicating the number hey's is gematria 5. That is indicating and showing the 5 things that were lacking in the second Beis HaMikdash that were there in the first Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash we didn't have the aron. The Kapores and the Kruvin. That's all considered as one. The Ark, the Holy Ark. The Kapores, which is the cover with the Kruvin, are those bird-like statues that were on the top. On the second Beis HaMikdash, this was remained hidden in the underground caverns, somewhere deep underneath the Beis HaMikdash in the Temple Mount. Shlomo HaMelech had built a secret passageway and a hidden place to put the Beis HaMikdash, to put the Aron. And a little while before the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, there was a king who brought the Aron down into that hidden place. And by the second Beis HaMikdash, they didn't have it. The second thing that was missing in the second Beis HaMikdash was the Esh, the fire, the heavenly fire that came down to consume the sacrifice. Wasn't there in the second Beis HaMikdash, was only there in the first Beis HaMikdash. The third thing that was missing was, the Gemara says, the Shekhinah, which means the divine illumination, the godly presence. In the second Beis HaMikdash was far weaker and far less than the first Beis HaMikdash. To the extent that it isn't called that the Shekhinah is there. In the first Beis HaMikdash we had Hashra'as HaShechinah, because it was a great manifestation of the Shechinah, of the Divine Presence. Second Beis HaMikdash was very minimal. The fourth thing that was missing was Ruach HaKodesh. There wasn't any more prophecy. Nevuah stopped. The period, the era of Nevuah was during the first Beis HaMikdash. And then we didn't really have it in the second Beis HaMikdash. And the fifth thing that was lacking in the Beis HaMikdash was the Urim V'Tumim. That is a piece of parchment that went into the folds, into the crease of the choshen, of the breastplate, through which the high priest would get direct text messaging from Hashem. When they would have a question, they would ask, and the Kohen Gadol would look down on the choshen, on the stones, and they had the names of the Shvatim engraved, so he had all the letters of the Aleph Beis, and the letters would pop up. And that's how we knew, and he was able to figure out how to unscrabble those letters. In the second Beis HaMikdash, being that there was no Ruach HaKodesh anymore, the Kohen Gadol would need the special divine assistance to be able to unscrabble the letters, so that's why they didn't have that piece of parchment. It's an argument. Some say there was a parchment, and they just didn't use it. Others say from Rashi, it implies that they didn't even have the parchment. He still wore the breastplate with the stones, but that wasn't there. So there were five great things that were missing in the second Beis HaMikdash that were there in the first Beis HaMikdash. So it wasn't a complete nechama. It wasn't a complete comfort. It was somewhat of a comfort. However, when Hashem is going to give us the third Beis HaMikdash, so that is going to completely replace, it's going to restore the magnificence, the glory, to the old days, to the day it was in the first Beis HaMikdash, and then way beyond that. So that's why it's going to be a complete nachamu. So if that's the case, the question is, why do we need nachamu nachamu? Why do we need a double comfort? When a human being is comforting someone, being that we're not replacing that which they've lost. If they have had two losses, you have to comfort him two times. But if a person, for instance, loses their home, they built their dream home, a beautiful home, and some natural disaster came and destroyed their home, whether it was a fire or a flood or so, or the like. And then they managed to rebuild their home, but they don't have the financial means to fully restore it to its pristine beauty as it was originally when they built it. Not a semi-reconstruction. So they're comforted, but they still have a gaping hole in their heart because they're lacking their remembering the home the way it was. And then finally, and then there is a second destruction. Second time that the house is destroyed. And then they rebuild the home. This time they manage to rebuild it and bring it back to its original glory. So they're comforted. So you say, oh good, now I have my home back. Their dream home, the home that they wanted. They'll say, well, you're comforted twice. You have your first home and your second home. Second home is irrelevant because the second home was only somewhat a little glimmer of the first house, of the first home. If Hashem is going to give us back the first Beis HaMikdash, a third Beis HaMikdash, which is going to be equivalent and even greater than the first Beis HaMikdash, so inevitably it's going to be a comfort for the second Beis HaMikdash too. Why does the pasuk have to emphasize Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami? You're comforted twice for the first Beis HaMikdash and for the second Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash, this leads us to say that there must be something about the second Beis HaMikdash that is superior to the first Beis HaMikdash. Something really great. The second Beis HaMikdash possessed certain quality that the first Beis HaMikdash didn't have. So even though, on the one hand, there wasn't a full replacement for that, for the first Beis HaMikdash, but on its own, it had some qualities, some uniqueness, that only was only there in the second temple, not in the first temple. So if Hashem would have only restored to us what we had in the first Beis HaMikdash, it wouldn't be a full, complete comfort. To completely comfort the Jewish people, he has to give us a Beis HaMikdash that contains within it the qualities, the beauty, the greatness of both Beis HaMikdash, the first and the second. Indeed, the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Baba Basra, on the Pasuk, It says, Godol yeh kvoid abayis ha'achron min harishon. That the second house is going to be the glory of the second home, is going to exceed the glory of the first home. The achron, the latter home. It's a prophecy, thinking Yecheskel, where it speaks that the future, the Beis HaMikdash, the late Beis HaMikdash, the latter Beis HaMikdash, is going to be Godol, greater than the Rishon and the first Beis HaMikdash. So the Zohar says, what is it referring to when we say Bayis HaAchron, the latter home? It's referring to the future Beis HaMikdash. Referring to the Beis HaMikdash HaShlishi, that we understand that the third Beis HaMikdash is going to be greater than the first Beis HaMikdash. Based on English. But the Gemara in Masechtas Baba Basra says, Dav Gimel, that when we say Godol Yegoved Abayis HaAchron Min HaRishon, it's referring to the second temple. That the second temple was greater, the honor of the second temple was greater than the first temple. In what sense? This is an astonishing sense, a statement. The Gemara explains, why is the second Beis HaMikdash greater than the first Beis HaMikdash? It says something that seems not to make any sense at all. You know why the second Beis HaMikdash is greater? Because bibinyan ubishanim, in structure and in years, it's greater because it was a greater structure. It was larger. It was a bigger edifice. The room was taller. It was a larger structure. It was a larger Beis HaMikdash. So it was greater, Godo. It also lasted for a longer time. The first Beis HaMikdash lasted for 410 years. And the second Beis HaMikdash lasted for 420 years. So it lasted an extra 10 years. And that's why the second Beis HaMikdash is greater than the first Beis HaMikdash. What's so astonishing about that? We're measuring the Beis HaMikdash. A Beis HaMikdash, a house for God. Beis HaMikdash is not just a nice building. There were many, many magnificent buildings in the world. Could be buildings that maybe exceed in their structure, in their thing, than the Beis HaMikdash. Who knows? In size, the Beis HaMikdash doesn't claim to be the biggest building. There are far greater buildings than the Beis HaMikdash. The greatness of the Beis HaMikdash is that the God dwells there. This is the home for Hashem. So in the first Beis HaMikdash, we understand what's so great about it. We spoke about five things. There is the Aron, there is the Shechinah, there is the Urim V'Tumim, there is prophecy. This is awesome. This is the greatness of the Beis HaMikdash. Second Beis HaMikdash, oh, it's greater than the first Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because it's a little bigger room. Who cares about the size of the room? How does that, why is that the barometer on which we measure a Beis HaMikdash? And even this, that it lasted an extra 10 years. Well, that was, of course, great and special that we had the Beis HaMikdash longer. But that's also an external thing. After all, godliness, Hashem is not measured by time and space. He transcends time. So what sense is it to say that the Beis HaMikdash is bigger because of this, that it lasted longer? A Beis HaMikdash is greater when there's a greater revelation, Gilui HaElokus, there's greater Kedusha, there's greater sanctity, holiness, miracles. That's the Beis HaMikdash. How can the verse, the Pasuk, say about the second Beis HaMikdash, Godli Yekoved Abayis HaAkram and Arishan, because it has... It's a bigger structure and it lasted longer. So you have to say that the second Beis HaMikdash possessed the spiritual quality that made it greater than the first Beis HaMikdash, different than the first Beis HaMikdash. That spiritual quality was expressed in the second in the Beis HaMikdash lasting longer and occupying more space. It's not the space itself or the larger structure or the time that it lasted. It's what that represents. What does that say about the spirituality of the Beis HaMikdash? About the godly content of the Beis HaMikdash? The Beis HaMikdash is not the first place where Hashem resided in. We know that before the Beis HaMikdash, we had the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, the Ohel Moed, the mobile home where Hashem was traveling through the desert with the Jewish people. And then there were other structures that were also called Mishkan. Mishkan Shiloh, the Mishkan that was in Gilgal and Nov and in Givon, other places that we had a Mishkan. When the Gemara talks about the Mishkan, it says that the Mishkan is called Diras Arai. It is a temporary home for God. The Beis HaMikdash is called Diras Kva, the permanent dwelling place of Hashem. This is a temporary home and this is a permanent place for Hashem. Like the Pasuk also says in one of the Parshiyos, Kiloi Vasem Adato El HaMenucha Ve'El HaNachla. You haven't come to La Nachla, to your permanent residence, to the inheritance. Nachla is referring to the Beis HaMikdash. That all the time that the Jews are traveling, and even though they have the divine presence amongst them, this is only a temporary thing. This halachti bo'el, I am walking in a tent. Hashem hasn't found a real residence, a place where he can call his home. Until the Beis HaMikdash, until the future, until the Beis HaMikdash is going to, until the Beis HaMikdash was built by Shlomo HaMelech, it was just a temporary home. And here the question is a simple question. What makes the Beis HaMikdash a permanent residence, an everlasting edifice, a home for God? It was destroyed. Even the first Beis HaMikdash is called already Diras Kva, the permanent home for Hashem. It lasted for 410 years. Then it was destroyed. Second Beis HaMikdash, 420 years. In what sense is it the permanent residence? They'll say, well, that's a long time. That's quite permanent. Who lives in their home for 410 years? I mean, an hour scale. That's a long time. Well, let's take a look at the Mishkan. The Mishkan Shiloh stood for, not exactly sure, but it's around 370 years, give or take. I think 367 or 369. In that vicinity, that's a mere 40 years less than the Beis HaMikdash. But nevertheless, the Mishkan is called the temporary dwelling place. The Mishkan, the Beis HaMikdash, oh, this is Hashem's home. Why? What is so essentially different between a house and a home that Hashem lived for 370 years and a Beis HaMikdash that he lived 410 years. So obviously, the element over here is not time. Not the amount of time that he dwelled in the Beis HaMikdash. But it was the manner in which he dwelled in it. The manner in which godliness was expressed in the Beis HaMikdash. The world is in a constant process. Hashem created the world. Initially, when Hashem created the world, as the Medrash says, Iker Shechina b'tachtoinim hoiso, the divine presence was found all over the world, down here below. Our world was permeated with God's light. However, as a result of sins, as a result of man's sins, seven generations, as the Medrash says in Shir HaShirim, generations of first Adam, who ate from the Eitz Hadas, and then the generation of their children, Cain, that killed Hevel, and then there was the sin of the Dor Enosh, and then the generation of the flood, the generation of the Mabel, and the Dor HaFlaga, and then Sidon, and then the Mitzrayim. So these various different generations chased the divine presence away from this world. And God ascended up to heaven. Up to the seventh heaven. Higher and higher and higher away from the world. And the purpose of the Jewish people, beginning from Avram Avinu, is to bring the creation back. And reunite the creation with Hashem. Merging God in the creation. Unifying the world with Hashem. That's the purpose. It was achieved for the first time where the creation was filled with godly light. Again, beginning with Avram Avinu. Avram began to reveal godliness in this world, make people conscious and aware of Hashem. Vayikra sham b'shem Hashem, he went around calling in the name of Hashem, speaking about Hashem, and so on for seven generations, bringing Hashem the Shekhinah down through the seven heavens. Finally, Moshe Rabbeinu was the seventh one, brought God down to the world. By Matan Torah. By Matan Torah, the world was filled with godly light. The Ten Commandments echoed throughout all of creation. All over the world, they heard Hashem speaking. The world was bathing in godliness. The entire globe was illuminated with the divine radiance. However, it was a very momentary thing. Godliness, Hashem's light, enveloped all of the creation. But it wasn't absorbed. It didn't click. The world didn't take it in. For the moment that it happened, it was powerful, it was strong. But it remained on the outside. It didn't click, it didn't register. It wasn't assimilated into the world. And the proof to that is, as soon as the sound of the shofar blew at the end of Matan Torah, everybody was able to go on to the mountain. This incredible mountain where Hashem came down, he descended. God himself, this wasn't just a divine manifestation. This was Anoichi, Hashem's very self, higher than every revelation, was revealed down here on a mountain. And the light and the power of God on that mountain was so strong that anybody who would touch that mountain would be electrocuted. Instantly. They had to put boundaries, no one go up on the mountain. A moment after the Shekhinah departed, there wasn't a lingering effect. There wasn't a trace of anything on that mountain. You can let the cows go up and graze on the mountain. 2 minutes ago, Hashem was speaking on this mountain, and now a cow is walking on the mountain? Your donkey is running around on the mountain? Are you supposed to get upset about it? Is anybody supposed to mind? No. It's perfectly fine. Why shouldn't the donkey go on the mountain? There's grazing, there's pasture land, go up, feed your donkey, feed your horse. No problem at all, because it's our ordinary mountain. The mountain is as mundane as it was the day before. It was holy, yeah, when God was speaking. When Hashem was down here, it was holy. Afterwards, it went back to its natural state of being an ordinary mountain. So the process began. In beginning to absorb godliness into this world, the world has to start becoming like a sponge to take it in, that it should become part of the creation, it should be integrated into the very, very substance of the creation. For that, we built a Mishkan. Over here already, there was going to be the divine presence with the Jewish people in this world, not just for a half an hour, for an hour, but by day and by night, for weeks, for months, for years. It will travel with them wherever they go. Godly light took hold of the world. And it's not just that there was Kedusha around the Mishkan. No, the very Mishkan itself became holy. Hashem's light entered into the walls of the Mishkan on all four levels of the creation, because the Mishkan was composed of every element, the four elements that compose a physical life. Human beings who walked into the Mishkan were inspired. Moshe would walk into the Mishkan and he would experience divine communication. Nadav and Avihu walked into the Mishkan and their souls expired from the sweetness of the godly radiance that was shining in the Beis HaMikdash. When a Jew walked into the Beis HaMikdash, his heart was aglow, his mind was illuminated, and his heart was fired up with passion. You know what it meant to pray in the Mishkan? So the human beings were filled with godly light. But it also reached the animal kingdom. Animals were offered as sacrifices. The actual substance of the Mishkan itself reached the animal world, because the tapestries on the top were made out of animal hide and of wools and so forth coming from animals. The walls were constructed from cedar trees, from the vegetation. And holiness and godliness reached so far down that it reached into the very mineral world. The earth, the floor, the ground of the Mishkan was sand, the sand of the desert. And that sand was permeated with light. There was holy light, holy sand. Where do we see this? That the sand itself contained holiness? We know from the story, from the process of the Sota. A woman that wasn't faithful to her husband was brought to be tested in the Beis HaMikdash. And they gave her to drink this drink that was mixed with water. As it says, you have to take Afar Asher Bekarka HaMishkan. You have to take earth that is from the Karka HaMishkan, from the ground, from the soil of the Mishkan. And you put it in and you mix it in. And if she sinned, so then she would die. Why? Because the sin would not be able to stand the holiness, or the divine, the godly light that was in that earth would be like acid. The body was convoluted and it was perverted. So as a result of the sin, so this is, it would be incompatible, and that's why. Chas v'shalom, that would happen, what would happen? So you see that the holiness permeated the very earth of the Mishkan. So the world absorbed the Kedusha. But not really. Why not? What happens when the clouds of glory moved and it was time to pack their bags? And the trumpets blew in the temple, in the camp. And they, all the Levian quickly came and they packed up the Beis HaMikdash, and Allah, we're going further. And they moved ahead and they went and they restructured the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, in a different place. So what happened with that sand? So the very Mishkan itself came along with them. What happened with the earth, the soil of the Mishkan? That was so holy and so godly a couple of minutes, a day before. Regular sand. There's nothing to it. You can make sand castles over there. You can go ATVing in the desert. Nothing. There's nothing wrong because there's no holiness there. Who knows? The earth over there in the middle of the Arabian desert where they were traveling is the same like the earth in the Mojave desert. Till today, there's no holiness there. Even though there was one place they stood, the Mishkan was there for 19 years. If someone was to trace and find that place where that earth is, regular soil. There's nothing to it. There is no Kedusha. Even though while God's light was shining there, it was saturated with intense holiness. What does that show? That in some way the light took hold of the creation, but it didn't really get absorbed, because if it would have been absorbed, it would have been there forever. If the earth would have changed, then it would have changed forever. It didn't change, it remained what it was. Because the world wasn't ready yet. This world is created with such tough klipa, such thick resistance, such a cover and concealment on godliness, that just because you're shining intense rays of light on it for a while, the unholiness doesn't give away because of that. It remains tough, resistance. As long as you're shining the light, who can resist God's ray? Very intense ray. But it hasn't been absorbed. Not so when they came to the Beis HaMikdash. And this is true even of the Mishkan Shiloh. Even when the Mishkan, when they built the Mishkan in Eretz Yisrael, there's a city called Shiloh. I don't know if it's the same Shiloh of today, probably. Maybe they know where Shiloh is. What happens if we find out where the Mishkan Shiloh is? Maybe they know. There's absolutely nothing wrong with making a tennis court. Or a swimming pool. Right? Which Yiddish Haaretz is going to say, well, there's a place in the Beis HaMikdash, you're going to make a swim. You can do that. There is no holiness in that land. It's an ordinary land. Not when they came to Yerushalayim and they built the Beis HaMikdash. And Yerushalayim on the Temple Mount is a whole different story. The Beis HaMikdash was built. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. And the holiness remains in the Beis HaMikdash. There might not be a structure. There isn't there the edifice. The building itself isn't there. But the Kedusha of the place is there forever. The Rambam says it in the end of Perek Vav, in Hilchos Beis HaBchira. in Halacha Yudalid, and then going on into Tezvav, where the Rambam says that when Shlomo HaMelech sanctified the Beis HaMikdash, he sanctified it Leshata, for his time, Ula Asid Lavayan, for the future. And therefore he says we can be Makriv Karbanos, that you're allowed to offer sacrifices, even if there's no Beis HaMikdash on the Temple Mount. There's a technical problem. We can't go there because we don't have a Parah Aduma. So we don't have the ashes of the Parah Aduma to get purified or whatever, other things. So we don't do it. But the holiness is there. And that's why no one is allowed to go on the Beis HaMakom HaMikdash. Why is that? Because in the Beis HaMikdash is a different story. Godliness came to the world. Hashem came down in the Beis HaMikdash to rest in the world. It permeated the very bricks and stones, the mount, the soil, the mountain, the soil. Changed forever. It became holy. And that holiness can never go away from it. Because it has been truly integrated and assimilated into the creation, into the very kishkis of the creation, into the very stomach of the creation, in the innards of the creation. It became one with the world. And that cannot go away. That's why it's called Diras Kva. It's a dira. It's a permanent dira. Something of permanence has happened. Now the difference over here is not just in what happens afterwards. Like what happens later, after the Mishkan was destroyed, or after the Mishkan was relocated, what happens with those substances? Where it was before, what happens later? That's only a measuring thing. The real question over here is, during the time that the Beis HaMikdash is standing, during the time that the Mishkan is standing, what's the relationship between God and the world? What's the relationship between the Jewish people and Hashem? Because the relationship of Hashem and the Beis HaMikdash is only reflecting our relationship with Him. What kind of connection do we have with God? It was seen in the Beis HaMikdash. But the question is not what happens afterwards, during the time that it is. Why? What's the reason for the difference? The godliness that was shining in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, was a godliness that wasn't coming from the creation. It was coming completely from God. It was coming from Hashem. How was Hashem's light able to reach even such low things like animals? Human beings with physical brains, and then animals and vegetation and even minerals? Because Hashem is omnipotent. Because Hashem has no limits. And therefore He can do whatever He wants. And nothing can stop His light. And He can break through even the darkest, most toughest material. His light is so powerful that it can reach everywhere. So that's why it reached even the Beis HaMikdash, even the most lowest of substances. It's like there are different kinds of teachers. There are people who can teach, and they can teach their colleagues, people that are close to them. There are people that have a greater skill of teaching, greater wisdom, and they're able to take information and ideas and teach it even for simpler people. Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men. It says about Shlomo HaMelech that he would say 3,000 mishalim, 3,000 examples when he taught. Now, why did he need 3,000 mishalim? And the explanation is given that it wasn't just another example. The idea was that he was able to take his wisdom, what he understood, and bring it down 3,000 levels. So he was able to walk in to a nursery class and explain the deepest concepts in a way that they can understand, and it would capture some of that brilliance. Like Shlomo HaMelech wrote Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is this book about romance. In there, it's contained in Shir HaShirim the deepest secrets of the mysteries of the relationship of God and the Jewish people. Nevertheless, he found an expression that can be understood even to the courses of minds. So Shlomo HaMelech can come and teach it even to little children. Could do it. Now what happens if we have even someone who is even wiser, hypothetically? No one is Chacham Yosem Allah. The Mashiach says he's going to be wiser, even smarter than Chacham Gadol, even Yosem Mishlomo, a greater Chacham. Ability to be able to teach to a butterfly. Oh, whoa. This is someone who is so, can even speak and transmit knowledge and ideas to a butterfly. And how about someone who is so brilliant, who can communicate ideas to a stone? Wow. Tremendous. But what does that say about the stone? What does it say about the butterfly? A smart butterfly? A clever stone? No, it's just an ordinary stone and a rudimentary butterfly. This man is so brilliant that he's able to somehow communicate even with things that have no brains. That's unbelievable. That was the first Beis Am. That was the Mishkan. The Mishkan was God's light was radiating and God has no barriers. But the world was still in a very immature state. The world was so dark, so thickly dark, and so resistant to godliness. It took hundreds of years of Jews performing mitzvahs. From when Torah was given till about 700 years later. About 400 or 500 years later, after the Beis HaMikdash was, after the Torah was given, that through the purification of the world, when we do mitzvahs, we're going to soon see, we purify the world, we purify and purify and purify, so the world becomes more refined. So finally, Shlomo HaMelech was able to build the Beis HaMikdash. Shlomo HaMelech was able to bring out that the world is ready for godliness. In a manner where the creations themselves are refined. They're able to receive. They themselves are able to process godly light into them and understand it and become one with it. And he built the Beis HaMikdash. One of the ways of understanding the difference between this transmission coming from above, transmission or the absorption from below. Talk about two students. A teacher has a student. And the teacher teaches. And the student understands. And the student, it's not just, there are students who are just mimicking or just repeating the words, but they're not really getting it. That's not really called absorbing in the first place. That means the light hasn't even reached there. Even though they're saying it in their mouth, but it hasn't really reached, meaning it hasn't entered their mind. So to teach somebody means that the concept has to enter into the person's mind. They have to understand it. But it's possible. And we see this all the time. Where the student gets it, understands that which the teacher taught. But if you're going to present the student with another problem and another idea, they have no clue. This subject that they learned, this problem that the teacher taught them how to tackle, they know, they understand. This thing, this idea, this, they really understand it, but only that. They haven't developed their own thinking skills, their own understanding, their own ability to be able to investigate, explore, study something new. And there is the other student who studies and learns. And finally, the teaching. The subject and the teachings that they've learned have refined their mind. They're able to study and learn other things. And the teacher has given them these tools, how to study, how to learn, how to explore something. Something has changed in the student's mind. That's true absorption. We see. That's the difference of the two base of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash. In the Mishkan, of course, there was an illumination. Of course, we've gotten it. It wasn't bouncing off. During the time that God was shining, the light was being absorbed. It's like the student who knows that which the teacher taught him, but only that. That's why when the teacher goes away, and real going of away with the teacher means not only the teacher goes away, but that very teaching that the teacher taught them went away. Now you're left to your devices. What can you do with your devices? The teacher is gone. Because there's a possibility that a teacher goes away. But the concept that the student learned is still in their head. Which means that the teacher is still in their mind. Because the teacher transmitted a concept and the concept is there. But we're talking in a case where, true, the teacher really left. What does that mean? That the student forgot the concept. Now, on your own devices, what can you do? Can you learn? Can you study? Have you figured something out? In the Mishkan, we didn't have that capability. The minute God's light went away, nothing was there. In the Beis HaMikdash, the illumination from above went away. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. The godly channeling of light from above wasn't there. But holiness is still simmering from below. Why? Because earth itself discovered its relationship with God. Earth itself got sanctified and got a connection and purified itself. A much deeper relationship. We see the difference of these two illuminations in the way, in the ones who built the Mishkan and the one who built the Beis HaMikdash. Who built the Beis HaMikdash? Who built the Mishkan? Moshe Rabbeinu built the Mishkan. What does it say about Moshe Rabbeinu? Pnei Moshe k'pnei chama. Moshe is compared to the sun. The sun illuminates. The sun shines. Tremendous light. The sun is representing Hashem. That's why the early idolaters, a lot of them serve the sun. Because the sun is a superpower of energy, of light. That's what we find even in Psukim, that Hashem is compared in a way of a muscle to the sun. Ki shemesh umagein Hashem, Elokim. That Hashem is compared to the sun. The sun, the source of light. Moshe Rabbeinu's face was the face of the sun. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu represented the perfect transmission of godliness to this world. There was one time that God had a microphone in this world, where his words were amplified. That was who? Moshe Rabbeinu's mouth. Moshe isn't representing the absorption of the creation of the world of godliness, because Moshe didn't have any creation element in him. Moshe was he was born pure. He was born with superhuman capabilities. That's why the moment he was born, there was hardly a body there. It was the Nesmala Kol Abayis Oira. The whole house was filled with light, because Moshe's body was only something tangible that we should be able to see godliness in this world. So it needs something physical through which Hashem's light can manifest itself and be transmitted outward. That was Moshe. Moshe says about himself, "Anachnu mo, I am nothing." And Moshe didn't eat, he didn't sleep, he went up to heaven for 40 days. It didn't. Why? Because Moshe wasn't much of worldliness. He was an Ish Elokim. He was a godly man. He was like a window to God through which Hashem's light shined to the world. That's why Moshe is compared to the sun. It's the complete radiance of godly light to the world. But light coming from above. Light coming from above with all of its intensity. Very intense, very strong. The presence of Hashem in the Mishkan was much stronger even than in the Beis HaMikdash. In terms of the intensity of the revelation. Because it's like the sun. Shlomo HaMelech, the Zohar says, the reason why Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, because Shlomo HaMelech was the 15th generation to Avram Avinu. 15th generation. So he's compared to the moon on the 15th day. On the 15th day of the month, the moon is full. The full moon. Soon he's going to have the Yom Tov of Tu B'Av. 15th day of the moon. What is the moon? The moon is the recipient. The moon represents creation. If God is represented by the sun, the moon represents the creation. The 15th day is when the world is reflecting God's light. When the world is completely absorbing that light from Hashem. Shlomo HaMelech being the world after it has gone through 15 generations of purification. 15 generations of purification. Now it's a recipient. And Hashem's light can manifest in it. So you have a Beis HaMikdash which can absorb Hashem's light. Earth was shining. The world was shining. The light of the moon, not the light of the sun. And in truth, it says in Kabbalistic writings, what this means in terms of the science of it, we'll talk another day. But it does say that the moon doesn't only reflect the light of the sun. That the moon, in some level, in some way, has an oir atzmi, has an essential light of its own. It's only that it's a very silent light, a hidden light. And when the sun shines on the moon, it brings out, in some way, the moon's own light. Just looking on the moon, just from a physical perspective, it seems to be just a dead thing. But there is an element of Ur Atzmi to the moon, its own light. When the moon's shining on the 15th day, it means not only that it's just bouncing off light of the sun, it is shining. The world was shining. The godly light has finally manifested itself in creation. Shlomo HaMelech built the first base of Mikdash. We began to get it. It started becoming part of who we are as human beings. We began to connect in an inner, deep way, to identify with godliness, with spirituality, with our destiny and our purpose in creation. There's a gradual ascent. However, the first base of Mikdash had its limitations. Great limitations. There is something that the second base of Mikdash possessed that the first didn't. Because this process of the world growing and absorbing is many stages. The ultimate base of Mikdash, in some sense, was the second base of Mikdash. How? In terms of the world's absorbing of that light. Let's go back to the teacher and the student for one moment. There is that student, as we said earlier, who can only, he only knows that particular subject, that particular idea that the teacher taught him. There is the other student who is able to, who gets the method of learning, understands the learning, is able to apply these ideas and this way of thinking to other things, which means the teacher has really trained the mind of the student. However, this is a student who, no matter whichever science or whichever discipline they're studying and getting involved in, which any subject they're learning, they will always learn on the style of the way the teacher taught them. The teacher has implemented and taught them how to think, and they're thinking within that method, the way the teacher taught them how to think. So let's say in the yeshivisha world, there are different ways of learning. There are the learnings of Brisk, very analytical, deep analytical. So there are students who go to Brisk and learn, and they come out and they have the Brisker way of learning, and they're very rich in the way they learn. But that's the way they learn. Everything is with the Brisker touch. And then there are those who study with the Tells, my way of analyzing things. There are the Polish ones, the Polish way of learning, and the Polish yeshivas and the Hasidic yeshivas in Poland was very charif, very sharp and pilpul and wild, and it was a different style of learning. And you have these students who the teacher sets them on a course, and then they can write svarim and make yeshivas, and they themselves become rich yeshivas, and they're like a carbon copy of the previous, this is the next Brisker Rav or so, the next great, not on that level, and of course on a lower level, but it's the same moving on in the same direction. But then there is once in a while a prodigy, a student comes out of a school and he learned by the teachers and he learned within a certain method. But the student goes off and initiates a whole new way of thinking and a whole new way of understanding. Why? Because the teacher has unleashed the powers of the student's own thinking, the own innovation, their own creativity. The student has, every person thinks differently. So you can think and continue thinking the way your teacher taught you to think. Or you can take it a step further and say, who am I? What do I think? What does my brain work? Of course, the teacher helps refine the process. But then the student has to look into himself and figure out their own talents, their own way of thinking. That's new. That's the real wisdom. Understanding when it's yours. In art, you have so many people who are artists and they're trying to copy the art of this artist and that artist. And they get very good at it, and some people get perfect at it. But from time to time, a new artist comes with a whole new style of art. This is their art. It's a new thing. Before we apply this to the three base amigdashes and understanding this discovery of our own, of something in it, something, a godliness that's coming from the world, from within the world. Let's for a moment examine our relationship with God on three levels, as it applies not to the Beis HaMikdash, but in other ways. Our primary avenue of connection to Hashem is in three things: through Torah study, mitzvah observance, and the third one is through tshuva. These represent three different elements in our lives, three different modes of connection. Torah represents a godly revelation from above. When we're studying Torah, what are we doing? In Torah, we're not really supposed to innovate anything. As strange as that sounds, you're not supposed to innovate. You're supposed to figure out what the Torah says. In Torah, you're tuning in to Hashem speaking. Torah is godly wisdom. It's Hashem speaking to the world. It's His knowledge. It's His opinion, His ideas. That's the Torah. I would say, wait, hold it. Well, what do all the generations been doing? What's with Torah Shabbat Peh? The oral law, didn't they innovate? They didn't innovate. They extrapolated. They dug in. They opened up the verses and figured out what the Torah means. But if you're going to say what you're saying, that isn't Torah. Torah is what God is saying. To know what he's saying. So Hashem gave Moshe Rabbeinu the tools. He gave him the 13 methods. You'd give him Midosh, HaTorah, Nedrashah, 13 methods of how we're able to figure out what the Torah means. And then, in the later generations, after the rabbis taught us the Torah Shabbat Peh, the basic skeleton of the Torah Shabbat Peh, and then we have the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam and so forth. So in all the generations, what are they doing in all the yeshivas? We're trying to figure out what it says. But you're not supposed to put in what you're saying. You're supposed to say what it says. So you study, you learn, you probe. What does Rashi mean? So of course, there's very interpretations. This one sees that this is what Rashi said. Another one says this is what Rashi says. But we're trying to know what Rashi says. And what is Rashi saying? That which he figured out what the Torah is saying. If you're saying your own chiddush and it's really yours and it doesn't say there, then it's... As it says, the Gemara says that every chiddush was given to Moshe in the Sinai. Every novelty in Torah was given to Moshe. But if it was given to Moshe, what's the chiddush? Then it's not a chiddush. So whatever the explanation of that is, but it says that there are some chiddushim that are real chiddushim. A real chiddush. Say, this guy is a real machadish. He comes up with new ideas in Torah. Well, if it's a real chiddush, it's a problem. That means usually it's boichter. It's his own stomach things. It doesn't say in the Torah. I remember in yeshiva clearly, there were two types of teachers. I remember it so clear when I was growing up. I felt it. That there were those who were very honest and they were very into what does it say? And they were learning the Rambam and they were learning it and studying and they were, and you can sense, they were trying to really, and they came up with very deep understandings of what the Rambam says, what the Rajba says and so forth. And you saw it crystal clear in the words. And if you asked them a question and you showed them it wasn't okay, then they realized, okay, it was a mistake. And they had to readdress it. But then there were those who were clear from the way you felt when I was learning them. Is that they had an idea, they liked it, they enjoyed it, and then they go and they take it and try to fit the Rashi and fit the Rambam to it, try to make the connection. That's not Torah. Torah is you have to hear what the Torah says. So it's not about us, it's we're open. Godly illumination is shining into our minds. The Eibishter is shining. Hashem's wisdom is given to us. Mitzvahs, then comes mitzvah observance. What is mitzvah observance? Mitzvah observance involves already the person and Hashem. Because in mitzvahs, we're not just allowing godly light into our space, into our consciousness. In mitzvahs, we're already engaging the world. We're engaging ourselves. We're going to change the world. See, Torah, you can have whether there is a creation or whether there isn't a creation. Whether there are people to study the Torah or whether people not to study the Torah. The concept of Torah exists. These ideas existed. Whether anybody's ever going to learn it or not going to learn it, it existed. It's there. It's a reality that exists without the world. Mitzvahs aren't that way. What is the definition of a mitzvah? A mitzvah means there's a commandment to someone. Someone has got to do something. So there has to be a combination, God and man together. Hashem commands, you do. To have a complete mitzvah, it's a joint thing. Without Hashem telling you to do it, it's nothing. Now that Hashem tells you to do it, it only becomes a mitzvah when you're doing it. So you have to concede and do what Hashem wants, and now you have a mitzvah. So here there is already a combination. There is a contribution of man. Man is contributing or getting involved. Here is a joint element. Also, in the physical substances, let's forget about the person for a moment. In the physical substances in the world, how are they impacted by Torah and how is it impacted by mitzvahs? The Torah addresses every element in this world. It speaks about everything. It speaks about commerce. It speaks about the economy. It speaks about family life. It speaks about the every issue in the world, there is nothing that Torah doesn't speak about. So it encompasses all of creation on every level. However, when Torah speaks about it, Torah sheds light. A lot of light on it. But the physical object through which the Torah spoke about hasn't changed because the Torah spoke about it. Let's, for instance, say, and more than that, even the person studies it. Let's say someone sits down and he's learning the laws of tefillin. He's learning the whole halacha of how to put on tefillin. Okay? And he learns that if you have tefillin, how do you make tefillin? You have to have a parchment. And the parchment comes from an animal. And you take that animal and you turn it into parchment. There's a whole process of how you turn it into parchment. Then you take ink and you write the parsha of Shema Yisrael and so on. Then you roll it up and you put it into a hide of another, of an animal, again for an animal. And there's the boxes, this week's parsha. Parsha Vaschanan has the mitzvah of tefillin. And you put it on your head. You finish learning... To finish learning that subject of Hilchus Tefillin, guess what? The cow is still walking around going moo moo and eating grass. Even though you learned the halacha about the tefillin. But the moment you're reading that there is a mitzvah to wear tefillin, oh, it's a whole different story. Now you have to go to the farm and get the cow and transform the cow into tefillin. A change is taking place. Down here, something is changing. The cow is now in a little bit of a while, going to turn into a beautiful pair of tefillin. Something of this world is going to enter into a godly state. A change is taking place. That's only in the mitzvah elements, not from the Torah. Torah is not doing that. Mitzvahs are changing. That's why the Gemara says an amazing thing. The Gemara says that Torah is compared to the light of the day, and mitzvahs are compared to the Oir HaNer, to the light of a candle. Torah is compared to the light of the day. Torah is called Or, Torah Or, light of the day. Mitzvahs are compared to candlelight, to a Ner. What is the difference between the light of the day? What is the difference between the light of the day and a candle? And a flame. The light of the day shines. It shines all over the world. And it's very bright. Incomparably brighter than a little candle. But the interesting thing about that light is that it doesn't have any impact on the world in a real way. What do I mean by that? It doesn't have any impact. Tonight is just as dark as yesterday. The fact that for 12 hours there was light shining outside over here on La Brea, there was light shining on La Brea, didn't make La Brea a little bit more luminous. The light isn't a little bit more, it's not shining even one bit more. It's just as dark. The fact that the sun has been shining over here for 1,000 years, a lot of light. It's just as dark now as it was 1,000 years ago at night. That light didn't absorb. On plants, yeah, there's the, whatever they call it, whatever the scientific thing for that. But there is some kind, but in terms of light, the light element of it becoming more luminous, that hasn't changed. It's just as dark. So that means that the light doesn't take the darkness. It chases away the darkness. It doesn't transform the darkness. Take a candle. A candle is not as powerful. It's not as strong. It's a little candle, a little fire. You put the fire to the wick, and what happens? The fire consumes the wick and the oil. And what is it doing? It's absorbing the wick. It's absorbing the oil. It's a converter. It's converting a substance that isn't fire, and it's transforming it to fire. Now, what is the fire? The fire was what was a moment ago oil, what was a moment ago a wick, has now become fire. Ki Hashem Elokecha Eish Oichlohu. Hashem is a consuming fire. Through a mitzvah, we're lighting a candle. The thing with which we're doing the mitzvah is the wick, is the oil. It, world, the creation, substances, your hand, your feet, the everything, the flower that's becoming matzah, the horn that's becoming a shofar, the parchment that's become, the animal that's becoming tefillin, or a Sefer Torah, this is getting consumed in godly light. It's been absorbed. It's a ner. It's burning it. It's incorporating. It's absorbing it. Mitzvahs penetrate much deeper into us. Torah is more light. Mitzvahs is more us. A greater, deeper connection to us. However, there is one more. There is one restriction to that. And here is where I'm going to wrap it all up. And there is one restriction to that. And that is that what? As great as the illumination of Torah is, and as powerful as the mitzvah penetrates, mitzvah's penetrating and getting deep into the world, elevating and purifying the world from within, after all, that illumination and that purification is coming from the fire, not coming from the wick. The wick itself is being overpowered by the fire. The fire is reaching it, entering it, transforming it. It's coming from the fire. If you were to have a little conversation with the cow and say, "Cow, what do you think?" And the cow will say, "I'm hungry. What's for lunch?" Say, "Oh, come on, let's talk about tefillin." Well, if you're stronger than the cow, you'll take the cow and slaughter the cow and turn it into that. It will become consumed by godliness. Godliness will overpower something. But the cow itself, it's what it's all about. It's about eating, sleeping, and doing whatever else cows do. That's the cow. There is, however, one deeper element, and that is a deeper question. What is the creation itself without godly interference, without any light coming from above, without Matan Torah, without the revelation, without Beis HaMikdash? What is the creation itself? What is the deeper inner meaning of every creation? What is the core of every creation? At the core of every creation, there is one thing, a spark of God. God is the truth. He is the truth of every creation, of every substance, of every element. He is the inner aspect, the root, the nucleus of every creation. Without any outside influence. We mentioned earlier, when Hashem created the world, the creations chased God away. What does that imply? What does that imply? That imply that the godly illumination on the world was external. It was on it, and the creations chased them away. So the world was left in what? In darkness. Now we're trying to bring back this marriage. There was a divorce, there was a separation, and now we're trying to bring them together again. The creation and Hashem should come together again. That's nice, that's wonderful, but there's a question over here. How about the creation without that influence from above? What is the creation on its own? At its core. The core of every creation is Hashem. When every creation digs into its root essence and asks itself, "Who am I?" every creation is godly. Because there cannot be a thing that isn't Hashem. Because Hashem is the root of all existence. He is what defines existence. And therefore, everything must be Him. Where is that revealed in our lives? Spirituality and holiness, not coming from the outside, coming from within. That's in tshuva. That's in a Baal Tshuva. It's a much deeper relationship with God. Far more pneumistic that's taking place. Because what's happening? Let's do for 1 second. Why does a Baal Tshuva do Tshuva? Someone who's somehow cut off his relationship with God. Someone who has drifted away. Gone off the godly radar. Moved into real dense and dark elements of the world. Where Hashem's light isn't reaching him. Because he's not connected anymore to Shabbos. He's not connected anymore to transition. Tradition. There isn't that unbreakable chain going back to the Torah, to Avraham Avinu. This person has assimilated completely. Disconnected, wandered off. Suddenly the person is coming back. Something in him is not sitting well. And the person is doing tshuva. Why are they doing? That's not a spiritual light that's reaching them from the outside. That's the inner core of their own soul. Their root, their essence. Because deep inside, this is who they are. They are a Jew. And just a little example for that. Imagine, we all have antennas in tennis. So like on a car, you have your antenna on the car, antenna, and you're going into a parking lot. So generally the radio works. The antenna picks up the radio waves and you can listen to the radio. You go into a parking lot. You go down one flight of stairs, one story down. So it starts getting a little staticky. Go down a second story, it gets even worse. Till you go down 7, 8, 9 stories, deep, 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 blank, you don't hear anything. Because there's a complete cutoff. It's so far and deep in the ground that there cannot be any communication. The antenna is completely cut off, you're off the radar screen. So it's not connecting. A Jew, generally, there is a certain divine radiance that reaches every single Jew. Chas v'shalom, a Jew gives up Shabbos. And he gives up family purity. And they give up tefillin. And they get up. So they're cutting off. They're going into this into this, God forbid, into this garage, deeper and deeper and deeper, to the point when nothing means anything. Yom Kippur doesn't mean anything. Even this, that can even Chas Hashem go ahead and intermarry and have non-Jewish children and so forth. Change their name. Nothing. Didn't even change it. Never even knew that they have a Jewish name. And suddenly, Epis, something, they're searching, they're looking. Why? Because you can run and run and run from outside influences. If Judaism would be external, if it's something that is given to you from the outside, you can run. But ultimately, you have to face yourself. And who are you? You yourself. Not from the outside. You, at the core of your being when you look in the mirror. Who are you in the inner self? You're a Jew. This is your godliness, not from the outside. From your own neshama, from your own, from within yourself. That's tshuva, much greater than a mitzvah. Because in a mitzvah, we're taking godliness, Hashem's commandment, and we're assimilating it into us. We're assimilating it into our hands, into our feet, into the object that we're doing the mitzvah. There is fire that's burning a substance. In tshuva, you're not burning a substance from the outside. It's the inner spark. It's like fire coming off of a flintstone. It's like the atom itself exploding from within it, not from any outside external influence. The ultimate revelation of the truth of the unification of the creation and Hashem comes through the doing of tshuva. That is, and when Jews do tshuva, when the Jew reveals his core, that his relationship with Hashem is who he is and what he is, what he or she is, that influences the creation too. That the creations themselves stop seeing God as an influence on their lives from the outside, but that's who they are. When you meet the cow says, by the way, part of me is milichik, part of me is fleshik, and then you can use this part of me for tefillin. That's who the identity of the animal is. It's the creations themselves realizing who they are from within themselves, not influencing from the outside, just the connection, because the truth of all of existence is Hashem. Tshuva reveals and uncovers the essence of the creation from below, not through any influence from above. It is for that reason, interesting thing, that in tshuva, we know that the mitzvahs you can only do with certain things. With kosher things. What can you do a mitzvah with? You can do a mitzvah with kosher substances. You can only make a sefer Torah from a cow. You can't make a sefer Torah from a horse. You can only use for a shofar a horn from a kosher animal. You can't use it from a non-kosher animal. All the mitzvahs can only be do. Esrog, you can't use an esrog from the first 3 years of a tree. It's arle, you can't use it. Why? And the answer is because when you're doing a mitzvah, you're bringing godliness down into the object. Certain things are able to receive it. Certain things are not able to receive that light. For example, let's take a look at fire. When you're burning a candle, a candle burns on a wick. What can the candle burn? The candle is able to burn a wick. Can you light a stone? Why can't you light a stone? Because in order for the light, in order for the fire to take on the stone, the thing, the substance, needs to have some pores, needs to have some holes for the fire to enter into it, to take hold of it. Something that's very dense, thick, hard, the fire can't get into it. So the same is with the mitzvah. Godliness can only take hold of certain things that are not so dark. Things that Hashem says is sinful is a sign. The Hasidic and Master say that it's so dark that godliness can't reach it. You know what the amazing thing when a person does tshuva, what happens? All the ham sandwiches they ate, the bacon and the eggs that they ate, the lobsters, all that stuff, all the non-kosher relationships all become mitzvahs. When a person does tshuva, it's a transformation of all the darkness. How can there be a transformation if it's so dark and doesn't allow God light in? How can you transform it? How can you turn it into holiness? The answer is, when you're trying to knock godliness in from the outside, there are certain things that are too tough. But when you're revealing that the essence of everything is Hashem, that's what the Baal Tshuva does. The Baal Tshuva cries out that I can run from Hashem from today till tomorrow. I, at the core of my being, I am godly, that's who I am. I am. So then that reveals the same thing in the world. And there is a spark of godliness in everything, even in the darkest evil. It is for that reason that tshuva is so powerful. Because there isn't a darkness that tshuva doesn't reveal. The Baal Tshuva uncovers godliness from the very, very low. That is the greatness of the second base HaMikdash over the first base HaMikdash. Because in the second base HaMikdash, the first base HaMikdash, Jews were tzaddikim. The Mishkan, just one moment, the Mishkan was like Torah study. It was a godly revelation from above. It didn't affect the world at all. First Beis HaMikdash was like mitzvahs, because the Jews were tzaddikim. They were taking the Kedusha, the holiness, and implementing it into the world. Influencing the world, bringing Kedusha into the world. And the world absorbed it, like a mitzvah. In the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, the Jews have drifted off. They were sinful. They were in that parking lot. They've gone into Golus, into exile. They were in a very dark place. They lost their divine communication. Then they did tshuva. They were Bali tshuva. When they were Bali tshuva, they brought about a whole different kind of a Beis HaMikdash. You know what was amazing about the third Beis HaMikdash? We built it not through a prophet. That was two. Meaning not through communication from above. The Gentile king, Koresh, was the one who told them to build the Beis HaMikdash. The Goyish king, the non-Jewish king, was name of Koresh, the Persian emperor, told them to build the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because holiness wasn't coming from above, holiness was coming from below. It was shooting out like geysers. It was coming forth from the creation. The non-Jew said, build the Beis HaMikdash. What's the greatness the Gemara says about the second Beis HaMikdash? It lasted longer, and it was a bigger structure. Why? Because what is the parameters of this world? What is the character of this world, time and space? Indicating that the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash was coming from time, was coming from space. So it occupied more space. It took up longer time. That's the greatness. The first Beis HaMikdash was greater in terms of godly revelation from above. The second Beis HaMikdash was greater because it was the Baal Tshuva Beis HaMikdash. It was godliness issuing forth, shooting forth from below. Each one has its quality. The third Beis HaMikdash is going to possess both qualities. The greatest revelation from below, from above, and at the same time, it's going to be very personal. It's going to be us. It's going to be coming from us, from who we are and what we are. In our own lives, we have three periods in our lives. We have times when we're illuminated by great illumination, great light, we're enjoying it, we're having a tremendous Shabbos. Or when we're in yeshiva, when we have moments of light, it can be on the Yomim Tovim, on the high holidays, or whenever it is, when we are experiencing a tremendous glow of godliness in our life. And then there are the times when we have the struggle, when the body is resisting, when the body is not in the mood of Shabbos, it's not in the mood of putting on tefillin, we have to drag ourselves to shul, to daven, and so forth. There is all the resistance coming from within ourselves. And we're yearning for those moments when it was so lichtik, when it was so much light. And then there is even a darker place, when we, God forbid, drift into absolute darkness through sin and just there isn't any light in our lives. And that can become very, very, very disheartening. So we have to realize that this is a progression. The progression of becoming unified with godliness comes in three stages. Initially, there are those moments of light. The reason why it's so bright is because it's not really us. That's because we're in the direct path of sunlight. Hashem's light is shining upon us. We're in the Mishkan, where there is this great illumination, but it doesn't have much with us. And because we're not engaging ourselves in it, we're just being recipients of that light, it's for that reason that we're not having the resistance. However, when we are countering a struggle, that's because the I has emerged, the person has emerged, and the person is not always consistent or ready for that submission to Hashem. So there is the struggle where we try to overcome the laziness, the apathy, the coldness of the body and implement light into it. That's the Beis HaMikdash, where we're taking the Kedusha and the holiness and transmitting it into our lives, into the body, into those substances that are not yet comfortable with godliness. And then, when we get into real darkness, when we drift into Chas V'Shalom, into those dark, dark areas where we completely disconnect from Hashem, true, that's our fault and we should never go there. But but if that has happened already, we have to realize that that too is an opportunity to deepen our connection to Hashem. That's when tshuva comes in. We have the ability of doing tshuva. Tshuva is a time when we can discover our own godliness, precisely because we have completely cut off all the cables of the connection. Precisely because we have utterly disconnected, and there isn't any influence from the outside. Here is where we discover our inner cry, the true aching cry of the neshama, of Ashiveinu Hashem Elecha v'nashuva, return us to you. If this is what I really want, this is what I am really all about. And that's the second Beis HaMikdash. The third Beis HaMikdash is going to envelop all three elements of the Mishkan, the first Beis HaMikdash and the second Beis HaMikdash, all in one. Let it be revealed speedily in our days.